start in chapter 10. If you're visiting with us, we are really super glad that you're here. All right. Join with us. And what we are is just a bunch of people that love the Lord Jesus Christ, and we're doing our best to be conformed into his image, and we're doing our best to just walk with him. And what we started in January, we've taught through the word. I've taught through the word about three times in the last 30 years, consistently, verse by verse. This time we decided to speed it up a little bit. We started in January using the one-year Bible as our guide. And so the entire church is reading the one-year Bible, and then we teach out of the sections you've read on Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday and Thursday nights in our midweek studies. And so we're all going together, staying on the same page, learning together. And you've showed up when we're just kind of been reading this week in the book of Nehemiah. And we're going to kind of just do a couple of things in chapter 10, a couple of things in chapter 13, and we'll be through. And I just have to add this, that there's a lot of food next door afterwards, okay? Our ladies' ministry put together, they overfed us today, and I'm scared because we've had beans and rice all day long. We had it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, okay? And then we gather together. Go figure, all right? So here we are. And so a lot of you didn't show up for dinner. They have enchiladas and terrific. I ate it all three meals. And then so afterwards, we're going to open it up again and join us and then go home, please. All right. A few years ago, Richard Simmons introduced a man to the world by the name of Michael on one of his weight loss infomercials. Michael had this amazing story to tell. After a lifetime of extreme obesity, he used Simmons techniques to lose more than 700 pounds, from 900 pounds to 180 pounds. And for the first time in his life, he was able to do things he had never done before. He was able to go places he'd never been able to go before. During the interview, Michael said that he was enjoying life more than he ever dreamed possible. And having overcome such a tremendous obstacle, he seemed to have a bright and happy future ahead of him. He had taken control of his life and had changed his destiny in this real dramatic way. Unfortunately, the change was short-lived. For some reason, Michael began overeating again. Slowly, he put on weight until he weighed more than he had at the beginning. Eventually, he was no longer able to even get out of bed. Incredible. He lost his business. He ended up on welfare. He had made this tremendous change in his life, but he was unable to keep the change. Stories like this make me wonder why it is so difficult to keep a commitment. We've all been in Michael's situation, maybe not to that extreme. A survey taken a few years ago revealed that more than 75% of all New Year's resolutions are broken during the first week of January. We don't have any trouble making commitments, but we have trouble keeping commitments. We're not the only ones. In the Bible, the entire nation of Israel had this problem. Theirs was a history of repeatedly falling into sin, getting forgiven, falling into sin again, getting forgiven, and on and on. And in Nehemiah chapter 8, the entire nation repented and turned their hearts toward God again. We talked about this morning. It was a beautiful time when they cried out and asked the priest Ezra just to read to them from the law. And as he read, their hearts were changed and lives were given back to God. And Nehemiah was absolutely determined not to repeat the same old cycle, not for it to happen again and again. So he implemented some principles to help the Israelites stick to their commitment. If you have made a commitment to change your life in some area, here are some ideas that will help you make that commitment, help you to keep the change. First of all, Chapter 9, verse 38. First of all, be a part of a group. Be a part of a group. You can't do it on your own, man. Be a part of a group. And because of all of this, we make a sure covenant and write it. Our leaders, our Levites, and our priests seal it. See, this is the principle of unity. There is strength in numbers. Nehemiah knew their chances of remaining faithful were greater if he could get the whole nation committed to the idea of holiness. Now, when I was growing up, and my dad is here, and he weighs everything that I say, and he tells me whether it was honest or not when I talk about history, but, you know, when I talk about our past. But when I was growing up, I was frequently told, in fact, it was quite often by both my dad and my mom, that I shouldn't be part of the crowd. And that I shouldn't go along with the group. You know, this advice is very, very good only when the crowd is wrong. When the crowd is right, we can benefit a great deal by leaning on one another for support. This isn't dependence. It's not codependence. It is interdependence. And it's a spiritual principle. Paul said in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 16, from whom the whole body joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Americans glamorize the Rambo type, you know? The solitary man who stands alone against the crowd and can just take on the world, single-handedly defeating every enemy that comes down the pike. Now, maybe a few of those people really exist. I don't know. I've never really met one. Now, maybe they really exist. But most of us need encouragement. We need support from others. You know, after all, I was thinking the Lone Ranger had Tonto. So he wasn't really the Lone Ranger, okay? He had a buddy, man. Jesus said in Matthew 18:19, again I say to you that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done of them by my Father in heaven. Christianity Today recently printed an article spotlighting the True Love Waits campaign. And I just heard about it again today on the radio, that this campaign is going to go to the next Olympics. And this campaign, this whole group, there are hundreds of thousands of teenagers who have signed a pledge promising to remain sexually pure until marriage. The media, popular music, Hollywood, Madison Avenue, and virtually every element of our society is trying to convince teenagers that no one waits. And thanks to this campaign, there are literally hundreds of thousands of teenagers who find strength in the fact that they are part of an extremely large group of people that share a common commitment. That they are going to wait because true love waits. Now, as the individual trying to do that by themselves, they wouldn't be able to. But when they realize all of a sudden they're in a group of hundreds of thousands of other teenagers who have said, wait a minute, they're going to wait, they've made that commitment, and I am going to wait. It was just on the news, I think it was today, and it became a big deal where this couple got married just this last weekend, and they'd made a commitment not to kiss until they were married. And they interviewed them, and then they did some research, and it's been discovered that there's a trend towards that kind of purity. That physical activity amongst teenagers and amongst young people, they're putting it on hold until they get married. Even fondling or kissing or anything else, man. I think that's incredible. And the strength to be able to do that is as others are doing the same thing. So there is truly strength in numbers. There is strength in unity. There's strength as we gather together and support each other. You have a better chance of keeping commitment if you can be a part of a group with the same goal. Creating lasting change in your life requires teamwork. Yet we need each other. We have to do it together. Secondly, I want to tell you to take responsibility for your actions. This is the principle of accountability. Nehemiah and his people made themselves accountable, and it says in verse 29, by binding themselves with a curse and an oath to follow the law of God. What does this phrase mean, binding with a curse? Well, it means if I break my promise, may a curse or judgment of doom be upon me. That's what they were saying. Binding with an oath refers to entering into a contract. the same as a legal contract today. By making themselves accountable, they were taking responsibility for their action. When the president takes office, when a doctor receives a certification, when a pastor is ordained, all of these make an oath to the people they serve to do their job with integrity. They make themselves accountable to a measurable standard. They are publicly taking responsibility for the job that they do. During World War II, a plant of parachute packers achieved notoriety because their parachutes opened only 19 out of 20 times. That's an average of 95%. That's not a good average for parachute packers. It may get you an A in school, 95%. But when you're jumping out of a plane, it's just not good enough. The manager of that plant developed a strategy to increase reliability. He required the packers to test the parachutes themselves. It wasn't long until it rose to 100%. See, that is the principle of accountability at work. And the Israelites made a commitment and acknowledged their responsibility to keep that commitment. They were willing to face the consequences if they didn't. They realized that keeping a lasting change is a team effort. It takes a lot of people's help to get the job done. Thirdly, I'd like to say to us tonight, keep first things first. Verse 39, we will not neglect the house of our God. In verses 30 through 39, you've read it this week, list a number of items that the Israelites vowed to keep at the top of their list. Things like marrying within their nation, keeping the Sabbath, making sacrifices, giving an offering, temple observance. This is the principle of priority. And without a doubt, this has to be the most difficult part of keeping any commitment. It's hard to prevent less important matters from creeping in and taking over because our choices aren't always as clear-cut as you might think. A friend of mine once warned me, and hear how this is said, okay? He said to me, the enemy of the best isn't the bad, it's the good. You can spend your time doing good things and neglect the best things. Are you with me? Did you understand that? We see in the story of Mary and Martha, while Jesus was visiting his friend's home, Martha was busy taking care of details while Mary sat at Jesus' feet. Martha became upset that Mary wasn't doing any work, and she complained to Jesus about it, saying, tell her to help me. I'm busy here. She's just sitting. Tell her to help me. And Jesus said to Martha, 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 you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. The Philadelphia Phillies, Mike Schmidt, was the National League home run champion 5 times and twice was most valuable player. A reporter once asked him, in fact, asked his father, what he thought of his famous son. And his father said, and I think this is great, Mr. Schmidt said, he is a good son. He is a good husband. He is a good father. He is a good ball player in that order. Don't you love that? I think that's incredible. Priorities. The church loses impact when we lose sight of our priorities. It's rarely a case of the church doing what is bad instead of what is good. It's most often a case of the church doing what is good instead of doing what is best. It's this way in our own lives too. When we make a commitment, we must constantly monitor our lives to make sure that we keep our priorities straight and keep first things first. This is so much easier to do when we're part of a group and we've made ourselves accountable. We have prayer groups. We have home studies. We have home groups. You can be accountable, man, and we need to be that. And when we make ourselves accountable, it is so much easier to keep our commitments. Because we realize it's not just unto ourselves. And it never is. Let me look at chapter 13 for a couple of minutes. Just kind of run over there, would you? We're going to finish up Nehemiah tonight. Talked about it for the last four or five studies we've been reading through. When we began this series, Nehemiah was a slave to the king of Babylon. And he became consumed with the idea of going to Jerusalem and rebuilding the walls of the city, which had been destroyed years earlier. Nehemiah oversaw the rebuilding of the walls and was appointed governor of Jerusalem. Later, the people realized that they had drifted into sin and turned back to God. Revival broke out, and the people of Israel made a commitment to God not to repeat the mistakes of their ancestors. Now, this would be an ideal way for the story to end. This would be great. Would be Book of Nehemiah, if it stopped there, that would be great. Unfortunately, it doesn't end there. The Israelites mess things up one more time. Nehemiah had to leave Jerusalem for 2 years. And when he returned, he found that things were not the same as when he left. In fact, things fell apart while he was gone. The Israelites went back to many of their old ways, abandoned the earlier commitments they had made to the Lord. And Nehemiah came back and he has to make things right. In the process, he learned what all leaders must learn. And again, let me remind you, if you've done the book of Nehemiah, let me remind you that we are all leaders. We're all leading somebody. Somebody's watching, whether it's your children, your family, people on the job, whether you're in ministry, whatever it is, we are all leaders, okay? But he learned what all leaders must learn. A leader's work is never done. Any parent knows he can't just show his child how to walk one time and then expect the child to do it right. You have to show them again and again and again. Any coach knows that you'll never get to the point where you don't have to drill your team on the fundamentals of the sport over and over and over and over again. That's because a leader's work is never done. A leader will never get to the point where he or she can stop leading. And what I want to do now is just kind of look at three roads that leaders must travel and travel again and again and again many times during the leadership process that I see here in chapter 13. Assert your authority. Let me explain that. While Nehemiah was in Jerusalem, a priest by the name of Eliashib offered a large room in the temple to Tobiah. You may recognize that name from an earlier chapter in this book. Remember, Tobiah had challenged Nehemiah's authority during the building of the wall. He'd even tried to get Nehemiah killed. And when Nehemiah came back to find Tobiah living in the house of God, he was ticked, man. He was upset. He'd had trouble with Tobiah. Remember the stories of Sanballat, Geshem, and Tobiah was terrible, man. So he comes back. They've given him a room in the house of God. Nehemiah comes back and he says in chapter 13, verse 8, and he says, "And it grieved me bitterly. Therefore, I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room. Then I commanded them to cleanse the rooms." Nehemiah wanted everyone in the city of Jerusalem to remember, in case they had forgotten, that he's the governor, he's in charge. If anyone had any doubts about who was boss, seeing Tobiah's belongings in the street might have helped them get the picture. When Jesus entered the temple and found the merchants selling sacrificial animals and others exchanging money at exorbitant rates, he took charge. He made a whip. He drove them out, man. He drove out the men. He drove out the cattle. He drove out the sheep. He knocked over tables. He scattered their money across the floor. He was reminding his followers and everyone else that he is Lord. He is the leader. And he was asserting his authority. If God has given you responsibility as a parent, you are the parent. You are the leader. You must keep your authority. You're not your child's best friend and don't ever try to be. You are the parent. Remain the parent. Say no when you have to say no. Say yes a couple of times in their growing up stage, but most of the time say no. You know? My dad used to beat me 3-4 times a week just for stuff he knew that I did that I didn't. He didn't catch me yet. That's not true, but. You know. But you are the authority. Don't relinquish that. It amazes me as I watch families and I watch little 2 or 3-year-old kids running the family. You know? Throwing little fits in the store, running the family, and it just boggles my mind. And they, oh, okay, we'll buy that for you, we'll do that. Who is this? This is the smallest adult I've ever seen. What is going on here? Yeah, just, you know, it's that old saying, give them to me for a week. You'll never see them again, man, ever. But it's incredible, man. Be the authority. Be the parent. If God has you in ministry, be that. Take that leadership position and don't acquiesce it away, man. Be who God has called you to be. Secondly, focus on priorities. Nehemiah also discovered that the people who were to live and work in the temple had not been paid. They left the temple and went to work in the fields. And Nehemiah was not pleased with the results. Look at verse 11. So I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Several times throughout our time in Nehemiah, we've seen that a crucial characteristic of leadership is the ability to stay focused on a goal, to keep first things first. We see it again here. The people of Israel were enjoying prosperity and freedom. It was easy for them to forget their responsibilities to the house of God, and Nehemiah got them back on track by helping them remember their priorities. A great leader once summarize the art of leadership this way. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. Okay? Think about it and it works. Okay? But we get that all messed up. Leaders must be willing to direct and redirect people to their priorities. It's a road that leaders must travel many, 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 many times. You're going to have to do it with your children over and over and over. And in any area of leadership, you're going to have to do it over and over. Keep the people focused that you're leading on the proper goals. Don't let them get distracted. Thirdly, enforce the rules. In chapter 10, the people of Israel made a commitment to keep a list of promises, including observing the Sabbath and not intermarrying with other cultures. They did this during a time of national repentance. They put their commitment in writing, binding themselves with a curse and an oath. And when Nehemiah returned from Jerusalem, he discovered that they were not keeping their commitment. Look at verse 15. In those days, I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath, bringing in sheaves and loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. Drop down to verse 23. In those days, I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Leaders are often tempted to overlook these lapses when everything else is going well. No one wants to create conflict when things are running smoothly. Nehemiah was not willing to overlook the offenses. He rebuked the nobles for desecrating the Sabbath. And he insisted that the people began observing the Sabbath again. And as for those who intermarried with other nations, I love verse 25. Get this. This is so great. I like this guy, Nehemiah. And I've asked God, can we go back to this time in history? Can I become like this guy? So I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them, and pulled out their hair. Don't you like this kind of, this guy is a good leader. You'd follow him, wouldn't you? Leave me alone. Okay. This guy is cool. At this moment, Nehemiah sounds more to me like a professional wrestler than a spiritual leader. And I hasten to mention here that it is possible to apply Nehemiah's principles of leadership without using his identical methods. So if I see all your kids coming in with their hair pulled out, you're not supposed to do that. Okay. All right? You don't have to use his methods. Well, after Nehemiah knocked some of their heads together, he made them take another oath, the middle of verse 25. You shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves. Yes, sir. Verse 26. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his God. And God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused him even to sin. Leaders recognize, and I want you guys to recognize, that little things add up. If we don't take care of problems when they're small, they will grow out of control. I learned that lesson from an episode of the Andy Griffith Show. One of my favorite characters, Barney Fife. And Barney says, we have to nip it in the bud. Do you remember that episode? It was so cool. There was this little old lady who was jaywalking. And Barney looks at Andy and he says, Andy, if we don't nip it right now, Maryberry is going to turn into Sin Town. We have to nip it now in the bud. We have to arrest her. She was the old lady jaywalking across this little street. No cars, but he had to nip it in the bud, man. He may have taken it a tad too far, I'm not sure, but he had the right idea. When things aren't going right, we need to deal with them immediately and not expect them to get better. Deal with them in your family. Deal with them in your ministry. Deal with them in whatever area that you're involved in leadership. Deal with the things so they're taken care of. Don't just expect them to take care of themselves. I've learned that lesson the hard way so many times. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. We need to take care of things. Nehemiah learned in the closing chapter of his book that a leader's work is never done. There are many roads that a leader must travel again and again and again. And if one wants to be a great leader, he must be willing to travel that road as many times as it becomes necessary. There are so many lessons in leadership to be found throughout this little book. And probably the most important is the one we just learned. Leadership is a never-ending process. Your work is never, ever done. Leadership isn't a part-time job. It's a full-time job. Leadership is not something you do. A leader is someone you are. And every one of us in this room, in some area, we are leaders. Let me just kind of wrap this up by just kind of reading something that Charles Swindoll wrote in his book, Hand Me Another Brick. And I quote, he says, in typical fashion, when George Allen moved to Washington, D.C. as head coach of the Redskins, he promised the nation's capital the moon. He told them it would be just a few seasons before he would develop the Redskins into a championship football team. He promised them the Super Bowl by the second season. The team had a brilliant preseason that first year. Then early in the regular season, they won several amazing victories. It appeared the Redskins were to be lifted from their common role of loser to the uncommon role of winner. As time passed, however, the inevitable occurred. They began to lose, and they lost, and they lost, and they lost. The blame fell, at least in part, not on Coach George Allen, but on a quarterback by the name of Sonny Jurgensen. In my opinion, one of the most gifted and effective quarterbacks to ever play the game. And Jurgensen possesses a quality I deeply admire, and I call it personal security. It seems as if no one could ever intimidate him. One day, after another defeat during the season, Sonny was getting ready to take a shower and go home. A sports writer leaned over to him in the locker room and said, say, Sonny, be honest now. Don't all of these off-the-wall remarks we write and all this public flack disturb you? Doesn't it make you want to quit when people throw things at you from the stands and when you get those nasty, dirty letters? Doesn't it make you want to quit? Sonny just leaned back, gave a big toothless grin and sighed. No, not really. I don't want to quit. I have been playing this game long enough to know that every quarterback, every week of the season, spends his time either in the penthouse or in the outhouse. Sonny's comment points out a very important fact. If it's true, Swindoll goes on to say, that if you are a leader, you'll spend your time either on the top or on the bottom. You'll seldom know what it's like to be in between. You're either the hero or the villain. You're either respected or you're virtually hated. People in leadership must live on the yo-yo of public opinion, under the gun of verbal jabs, as well as on the crest of great admiration. Being in the outhouse is a lot more difficult than those choice times in the penthouse. And he goes on to say it's when we are under verbal attack of the intimidating public that we show our true colors. And then he says, I have discovered after a number of years in the ministry that this is true even in the spiritual realm. You commit yourself to a life of faith. You declare before God and man that you are going to walk with him regardless. And suddenly, it happens. The enemy turns every gun he can upon you to blast you out of the saddle, to make you finish your season in defeat, to have you think it's really not worth it after all. Unquote. And that's a lie from the pit itself. If we realize that we're in leadership or whatever we're doing, like we said this morning, not to impress, but to lead. Not to impress, but to communicate. We're not here trying to win anybody's favor. I never tried to have my kids like me. That was their decision, man. I wanted to train them in the way that they should go. They still don't like me. No, they love me, okay? My grandkids, we have a great time. But that wasn't my objective. My objective in pastoring is not to impress you. My objective in pastoring is not to get you to like me or get you on my side. My objective in pastoring is to communicate the Word of God. I told you, and I'll close with this. I've said this before, I believe. Many years ago, the Lord began to just share with my heart one day. And he said, you know, Chuck, you're a great teacher. You're dispensing wonderful information. I said, thank you. He said, I'm not pleased with that. I said, what do you mean you're not pleased with that? I mean, we'd have a conversation this way, but this is what's going on in my heart with the Lord. And he said, what do you mean you're not pleased? I'm studying a lot. I'm giving the church everything that I can. I'm trying to meet their needs. I'm giving them as much information. And he says, that's exactly what you've become, as a dispenser of information. And I never called you to dispense information. I called you to give my life away. And you're not doing that. You're only giving away information. That hit me square between the eyes, man. And I turned and repented. And for the last 3 or 4 years since he confronted me with that, I've never been the same. I approach every time we gather together. I don't care if we're like it's in this morning where we had 4 services all over the desert, wherever they were. You know, we spoke to hundreds of people, man. Or whether it's a Sunday evening gathering with a handful, or whether it's in a home study, or whether it's sitting in conversation with you over a cup of coffee, man. I take that very seriously. Because God's called me to lead, and I take every study, I view every study as maybe this is my last chance to communicate and to give Jesus away to the people I'm going to be talking to. I don't mean that to sound morbid, but that's how I approach this. I don't care what you thought of the study. I really don't. I care about is if somehow I've communicated the reality of Jesus Christ to you, that you'll be closer to him when you walk out than when you walked in, that somehow I've given his life and made it real to you somehow today, because that's what it's all about. And I approach every time we gather together in that way, that this could possibly be the last time I'm going to have a chance to tell you about Jesus, man. And I want to do the best that I can to do that. And that's how we should approach our areas of responsibility. That's how we should approach our leadership. Every time the worship teams gets up here to lead us into the presence of God, they should approach us. Maybe this is our last chance on this planet to do it. Maybe he's going to call us home. Maybe as we're worshiping, we're all just going to leave this stage and end up in his presence, and we're going to be singing as we get there. Wouldn't it be great? But that needs to be our concept and our approach. Maybe this is the last chance you're going to be able to talk to that relative, that friend, that mom, that dad, that child, that brother, that sister. Maybe this is going to be the last chance you're going to be able to share with that coworker or that neighbor. Maybe this is the last chance you get to encourage that buddy that you're here with tonight, or that person you see across the room, man. Don't let that slip by. We're always waiting for the prime opportunities. Don't let it slip by. Because we may not have it tomorrow. Doing a graveside service for a gal from this church tomorrow that been part of this church for probably 25 years or so. A long time. She lived out her walk and she shared. She wasn't ashamed. Had a gal came up to me this morning and say, you know, Priscilla brought me to this church a while back. I'd given my life to Jesus Christ, and I miss her so bad, she said. Because she was my best friend, but she said, I thank you for being here, and I thank her for bringing me here, and this is where I've given my life to Jesus Christ. And I thought, wow, she didn't miss the opportunity, man. She brought her friend and led her to Jesus Christ. Now Priscilla's gone. She's in the presence of her Lord. Maybe that was the last thing God had her to do. Maybe there was nothing else for her to do, so he took her home. I keep waiting for the last thing, okay? I'm ready to go, man. And when he says do something, I do it as quickly as I can. Now? Yeah? If there's something to do, I want to get it done, because as long as there's something to do, I'm not leaving. When it's all done, when he's through with me, I'm out of here and I'm in his presence. But we have to stay focused. Focused on the task. Focused on the calling. And be who God's called us to be, man. Let's stand. Jesus, you're awesome. You really are. What an unbelievable privilege to take your word and to be reading through it, and then to see some stuff, some principles, and to see what happened in Nehemiah, Lord. We had to go through this book so quickly, but because we're moving on in our reading. But Lord, there's just so many principles here that, Jesus, we just need to let just penetrate our lives, our hearts. Lord, I pray for all of us in this room right now that we would be busy about our Father's business. We would be doing those things you've called. I pray for parents, Lord. It's so easy just not to make waves, and if things aren't too bad, just to let things slide. And Lord, you've not called us to do that. You've called us to stand for the truth, to make the decisions, to be the parents that we're supposed to be. God, give us the courage, strength to be able to be the mothers and fathers that you have created us to be, Lord. I pray for other areas of leadership on the job, in your body, wherever it would be. We would meet the challenge, trust you, allow you to fill us and lead us and guide us. We truly submit our lives to you, Lord. Meet every need here tonight. We choose to exalt you. Thank you, Jesus.